very thankful to Dr. White for some splendid lectures. I don't think any of you doubt the importance or value of literature, taught as it should be taught. It's unorthodox to teach literature inside a seminary. I'm sure it's not part of the classical seminary of yesterday, except that it certainly was part of, it certainly will have been part of the minor seminary, not part of the major seminary. And so it's sort of reinserting itself at the beginning of the seminary here, which is sort of the minor seminary. So the more things change, the more they stay the same. Nature reasserts itself, and the value of the importance of and value of literature for preparing a mind and a heart and a soul for the priesthood, for instance, if I'm thinking of seminarians, is clear, I think, to all of you seminarians by now. And those of you coming from outside, it's equally clear. You know what confusion and disorder there is out there, and what a complete monkey has been made of the teaching of literature. Because a new way of life is a whole new way of life. We call it the way of life is coming in place, the Catholic way of life. The Masonic world is being pushed and pushed and pushed by the Freemasons and their villainous allies in order to get rid of the Catholic world. It's Satan against Christ. It's very simple, basically. And the destruction of literature, the emptying out of literature, making literature ridiculous is part of that process. And then, of course, the glorification of technology, the importance of engineering, chemistry, physics, computers, technology, all of these things which are good for the nerds. But for human beings, zilch. I remember when I was at school in the 50s, there were three lines for us boys. There was the line of classics, Latin and Greek, there was the line of modern languages, and there was the line of sciences. Even as late as the 50s, there was still those who did the classics scorned those who did science. You know, I mean, science was just the pits. The scientists knew that time was on their side, and they knew they had the wind of the modern world in their sails, and so they didn't let themselves be beaten down by the classicists, but the classicists nevertheless despised the scientists, basically. The scorn was diminishing, but it was a classical scorn. But the new world is winning, of course. I mean, to all appearances, the new world is winning. But the new world is nothing. It's inhuman, and it's unlivable, and it's not working. And human beings remain human beings. They're going to remain human beings. They still operate on exactly the same passions. The geography of the soul remains exactly the same. The moral law, the Ten Commandments, the nature of God, the nature of the Mother of God, the nature of the devil, all of these things. Three score years and ten. Well, maybe that's been a bit extended by our hospitals, maybe four score years. But there's no significant change. It's only unimportant things that change. And yet the modern world is very different. But for seminarians especially, it's enormously important to grasp both what is the same and what is different. And for instance, in the O'Neill, it's the world, the flesh, and the devil. We had the four temptations of the four, the Catholic confronting the United States. Well, it's the soul confronting the world, the flesh, and the devil. You have dad who is, goes for money and the world, basically money. Mother who goes for the avoidance of pain, which of course comes back to the flesh. Not concupiscence, but the avoidance of pain. Jamie, who goes for women and wine and women, which is of course the flesh, and Eugene, who goes for the world, acceptance by the world, and pride, which is the devil. The pride of resisting God and defying God. So it's the world, the flesh, and the devil. Only in America, in the United States, the world, the flesh, and the devil are presented in a particular, with a particular coherence and sharpness, because the United States is founded in Protestantism. Founded in Protestantism, in Puritanism, worse than Protestantism, Puritanism. Founded in Puritanism and constituted by Freemasonry. Constituted by Freemasons. So that the dear United States is anti-Catholic in its very structure and nature. It's excellent that you should hear those things, seminarians in particular, that you should hear those things coming from an American. They don't come nearly so well from a Brit. It's easy to think that a Brit is trying to get his own back for the American Revolution or whatever, or he's sort of despising because he's European and doesn't really understand the United States. But when you hear an American saying it, it's different. It's different. Those are of the five books that the five authors looked at. I hate to say it, but perhaps Eugene O'Neill is the best value, at least from the point of view of understanding the United States, grasping the power and depth of the problem. And Dr. White gave a superb lecture on the freedom from religion, the freedom from thinking, and freedom from association. Religious liberty is the very heart and soul of the United States. And religious liberty is the crowning point of Vatican II. The United States is intrinsically anti-Catholic. The United States, as a United States, as a constituted nation with its ideals, and as the founding nation of the new world, as the launching nation of a new world, as opposed to the old Catholic world. The old Catholic world was made by the Catholic. The old world was made by the Catholic Church. The new world is consciously separating itself from, distinguishing itself from, and pretending to be superior to the old world. How does it do that? On the basis of religious liberty. That's the key to this, to the difference. And religious liberty, you seminarians know it from Acts of the Magisterium and so on. Religious liberty is the dissolution of thinking. It's the dissolution of truth. It's first and foremost the dissolution of truth. It's the dissolution of thinking. And the dissolution of the Protestantism is the dissolution of society. And as the family has certain, is very close to the natural law. It's impossible for a child to come into existence without there being a mother and a father meeting. And it's, although men and women are sinful and they want to go after other women or men, whatever it is, nevertheless, at the same time, that's the sinful tendency. There's a strong natural tendency for one man and one woman to stay together. The two tendencies are in, the man both wants to go off after the women and he wants one woman. The both things are there. One is natural and the other is sinful. The family is a very strong instinct. And obviously the family comes from God, society comes from God, the individual, the family, and the society should all be in sync. They're all designed to be in sync by God. So if the society is wrecked by Protestant principles, these crash into the family. And the longer the society remains Protestant, the more pressure comes to bear on the family. And most families have dissolved. The Catholic faith sustains the individual, sustains the family, would sustain society if it could. And so the family is the meeting ground of the crash between the Protestant principles, the New World's principles, and Catholic principles. And it's in a Catholic family where this clash is most strongly felt. And that's where the drama is. Eugene O'Neill, then, that play presents a, as Dr. White interpreted it, a very, um, it's a, It's a powerful picture of the forces of the Protestant society, or the world of flesh and the devil, as up and running in the United States, tearing at the family, and the family coming apart. And of course, the family coming apart is an enormous drama of today. Since O'Neill's time, it's just got worse and worse, and the family is almost ruined today, almost in ruins. But the church, the faith and the church, the true church and the true faith defend the family. And all over the United States today, where there is the real faith, the families can thrive. The situation is not desperate for those who don't want it to be desperate. The family can thrive. It can be made to thrive again. Just as if you adopt false principles, the devil will tear you to pieces. If you adopt true principles, God will. And how could God punish us for following false principles, or allow the devil to punish us, or allow ourselves to punish us if we follow false principles, and not reward us and help us if we follow true principles? It's absurd. So it's clear that the underlying laws all still apply. Only in literature, in that piece of literature, for instance, we get a clear picture of these laws in action. On the board is a composite of 3,000 years. Some of you seminarians know brown stands for nature and blue stands for grace. Here are the Greeks. Nature is declining, declining, declining since the fall. The Greeks were an uplift. The Greek drama, Greek philosophy, Greek science, Greek literature. And then it was again declining with the Romans. The Romans start 763. The Greeks are around 500 to 400, Athens. We come to the incarnation and grace lifts off. And as grace lifts off, there is the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. As grace lifts off, it within a short space of time, it's lifting nature back with it. Nature rises on a pontoon bridge, on a suspension bridge of grace. Nature rises to heights that it rises above the heights even that it reached with the Greeks, but as fallen human nature makes even nature with grace fall, both nature again falls off to lower depths than it's ever been, and grace is simply catus in free fall. And the result is going to be a very nasty crash of some kind. Then, where do we situate the authors? Chaucer is, if this is the high point of the Middle Ages, then Chaucer is in decline. He's rather Catholic than not, but he's certainly on the beginning of the decline. Shakespeare, likewise, is actually in decline. He is not so clearly sustained by grace. Or not so clearly Catholic. Chaucer is a bit naughty, so hold on a bit. We'll locate Chaucer there. Shakespeare is less obviously Catholic, but he's still very much carrying Catholic values. He's a carrier of the Catholic values. Then Emily Dickinson has not much apparently to do with grace. She's somewhere here, whereas O'Neill is, of course, crashing. He's well on his way down here. Who does that leave? I'm leaving somebody out. Dickens, yes. Dickens is somewhat like Emily Dickinson. Dickens profits from. There's more that's obviously Catholic in Dickens than there is in Emily Dickinson. It's the difference between Puritan New England and once Catholic Old England. New England was never Catholic. England was. And Dickens carries more of that. So Dickens is a little in time before Emily Dickinson. Dickens is profiting like Shakespeare from that, the Catholicism of England, the once Catholicism of England. O'Neill is the end of the line. Another very interesting lecture, as I seem to me, was on that movie, The Truman Show. Again, that of course is well down, not is even below O'Neill, although it's a little greener than O'Neill. O'Neill is fairly red. The Truman Show, the move from literature to cinema is interesting. America is not literary. It's because literature, why not? It's some people say, why isn't there an American literature? After all, America's been running up and running since 1776. Why? And America was there, and it was a self-conscious and independent nation through all of the 19th century. Why was there not much literature for the United States? Because literature belongs to the old world. And the United States is the new world. The literature of the United States, the talent and the intelligence and the belief and the conviction that go into literature in the old world go into technology in the new world. So the equivalent of literature in the United States is technology. And the United States is a new world. It's not the old world. It's a new world. And so Americans despise literature. A mass of Americans despise literature. Freedom from religion and freedom from thinking. It's absolutely true. We are constituting our nation on the basis of leaving behind all of those religious quarrels. The pilgrims came over the ocean when Europe was being torn apart by religious wars, and we want to leave those religious wars behind us. So so religion cannot be important, as Dr. White was saying. Religion in the United States cannot be important. It's going to be a toy. Like children become a toy. Religion is going to become a toy. And if religion is a toy, then truth is a toy. Truth is what is going to make you feel good and what is not going to disrupt people being together. Being together is all important. Unity comes in front of truth in the new world. In the principles of the new world, unity is in front of truth. And that's Freemasonry. If truth takes the back seat, then thinking takes the back seat, because what is thinking if not to arrive at truth? In all things religious and spiritual, then where's thinking still got to go? Thinking will go into things material. And therefore, the talents and the energies that went into literature, that went into thinking about life, thinking about things more than just material, thinking about things of the soul, even without grace, the talent that went into thinking about life, like Emily Dickinson is capable of it because she's shut away. She's in a little enclave. She's not exposed to the madness of this materialistic society. She's shut away with family and the garden and the flowers and she's capable of reflecting on life and on the meaning of life and immortality, but outside in the world outside, people are not interested in O'Neill if he questions materialism and technology. He does because he's Catholic. Because there's something Catholic in him, O'Neill questions materialism and technology. But people aren't interested in that. That's not got a public. In that film of Eugene O'Neill's biography. You saw that crowd, the theatre crowd of the 1920s milling around with all the lights flashing on Broadway and in New York. This crowd isn't interested in hearing that neon lights and technology and flashing lights, that all of that is junk. They don't want to hear that. This is their world. This is what they believe in. This is the future. This is what we are good at. Whereas the old world is good at things spiritual, we're not good at things spiritual. We're good at things material. Therefore, away with things spiritual and forward with things material. And we'll be good at central heating, we'll be good at paper clips, we'll be good at air conditioners, we will be good at Boeing jets. All of the things material, we will be masters of. And then, of course, if Europe gives itself over to the materialistic devils, Europe will go American, which is exactly what happens today. And the American seminarians go over to Europe and they are thunderstruck by the contrast between the handsome monuments, the magnificent monuments of the old world, and the jerks trying to belong to the new world, the human beings who are worse than Americans. I mean, when Europeans try to be American, they're worse than Americans. The Truman Show is human nature, human values struggling inside the same old human nature with the same old human aspirations for good as well as for evil, struggling inside this fabricated world of technology. Because as theatre of the old world is replaced by cinema in the new world. Painting in the old world is replaced by photography in the new world. Classical music in the old world is replaced by rock music in the new world. And even a talented musician who's thinking about what Charles Ives is schizoid. I don't know the music of Charles Ives, but it makes complete sense what Dr. White says, that he's expressing this clash between what remains of nature, of sane nature, even if we leave aside Catholicism, there's not much of Catholicism left, but sane nature. What remains in the United States of sane nature, much of which comes through in Emily Dickinson, and which is in Norman Rockwell, and which is, Dr. White evoked it in one of his lectures, that sane nature what was I saying? I've lost track. That's it. The schizoid, Charles Ives. That same nature is in conflict with the technological way of life, with the new world. The new world is at war with grace and it's at war with nature. The new world is tearing apart the faith of the Tyrones, and it's tearing apart the family bonds of the Tyrones. Sin is at war with grace, sin is at war with nature, with sane nature. Original sin, of course, is embedded in nature, but original sin is not God's nature. Obviously, the distinction between nature as coming from God nature as wounded with sin and as the seat of sin. In the Truman Show, what have you got? You've got a whole fake world fabricated against nature and against grace. And it's full of sin, but it's full of the attraction of sin. It's full of pride and it's full of sensuality. It appeals. It's very appealing to our fallen nature. This fabricated world of technology and machines and computers and so on and so on. The computers make us think that we are Lord of the universe. I'm omniscient and omnipotent. I can learn, I can know anything. I can punch up anything. I can punch up the Summa Theologiae. I can get a CD-ROM with a whole Summa of St. Thomas Aquinas on it and the whole Bible on it, which is a marvelous, to have it on a CD-ROM is a marvelous substitute for having it in my head and my heart. After all, who needs it in his head or heart if he's got it on a CD-ROM? I've got it with the CD-ROM. The computer makes me omniscient and it makes me omnipotent. I mean, I can go to the other end of the universe and I can do this and I can punch this and I can knock this down and I can build this up and I can put this on and I can put this down. Those buttons make me like God. Pride. The sensuality, well, if everybody knows what most of what I'm told 80% of the material on the internet is about. So the new world fits sin, and it does not fit grace or sane nature or God's nature. Emily Dickinson's nature, the garden, the flowers, the animals, the sky, the family, that will be torn to pieces. Pride, I refuse reality. I go into fantasy. I create a complete alternative world of which I am the master. A world without pain, a world without suffering, a fantasy world. And for that purpose, the cinema is better. The magic lantern is uniquely well suited rather than theatre. Theatre is fantasy to some extent, but as Dr. White says, it's still real actors on a real stage, and there's still real human contact. There's a two-way traffic between the actors and the audience. Whenever you're acting, if you act the same play, even just three nights, each night the actors will sense that each night is quite different. And I'm sure that even in a commercial run, in a commercial theatre, hundreds of nights, one after another, I'm sure that even there, the sense of the audience is different each night. Maybe not that much different, but still it's different. Likewise, a pianist playing for a live audience. How the audience reacts strongly influences how the pianist plays or the musicians play. But with the cinema, of course, there's none of that. It's a one-way traffic. The magic lantern is particularly well suited to fantasy. And then, of course, when to the magic lantern, the flashing pictures. I mean, you walk by a TV store, walk on the pavement by a TV store, and if they've got a TV set turned on inside the shop window, that's alone enough to, you can stand there and just watch. And the little children, of course, the flashing pictures just appeal. They have an appeal of their own, and they take you into a wonder world of their own. And then, of course, to add the talkies, when the talkies came in the end of the 1920s, that added another dimension of apparent reality to the magic lantern. The magic lantern seemed more real. And then, when the real seeming magic lantern is established in the home with television, and then when the real seeming magic lantern is at the control of my fingertips, and I've got a massive variety of which I am the master. I call the TV set I can only turn off or on, but the computer I can pull up this and that and the other. I mean, the temptation to escape from reality is extremely powerful, and the substituting of the fantasy for the reality is overwhelming. And I escape into the fantasy world. I mean, all of you know about the chat rooms and how people develop a complete personality, a computer personality, and they just fantasize about who they are, and then they meet some of the other side of the world, and just switch off the electricity and reality is still there. And it's like in one of those big jets going across the ocean, there you are sitting in this seat, and you've got these buttons, and now the latest 777s, you've got several programs. You can watch several different films, and you control film just on your own little screen in your own seat. That's the latest. It's no longer you have to watch the film that's there for the main cabin or whatever, and everybody watches the same film or they don't watch any. No, again the same process. They put the movie on the aeroplane, and you had to watch the movie that was there. Now, then in the first class, they had individual programming. Now it's in the main cabin, individual programming. That's the latest. So I push my little buttons here, sitting in this seat, and up comes a plastic meal, and up comes some plastic people, magic lantern people, and I go into the movie. The reality, of course, is still this huge thing going through the air, and if something begins to shake, something makes it shake a bit, would you all please sit down again and fasten your seat belts? I mean, you know, reality is still outside there. It's whistling past at 500 miles an hour or whatever. And just let one of the wings fall off, and reality is, just let the Russians shoot down, the Korean Airlines, a rocket coming up, and boom, reality is there. But people today are living in this fantasy. Eugene O'Neill, there's quite a lot of reality still there, interestingly. But it's losing. It's going to lose. The family's going to come apart, and they're losing the faith. The faith that's still there gives Eugene O'Neill a handle on materialism and technology and the disaster of the modern world. But people don't want to know that they are interested in the coming apart of the family, and I think that's the same thing. I think the Americans they're set upon their new society, but when the new society crashes into the family, to begin with they realize that something is wrong. To begin with they want to know what's wrong in order to defend family, but after a while they rather the false values of the new society, even if it means the disintegration of the family, and so they're letting the family go. The family is being let go. Rather lose my family than give up my fantasy. And the consequences are disastrous. Absolutely disastrous. Backtrack. Chaucer. Is a Catholic soul. That's back in the Middle Ages, Old England. He's naughty, but there's the human nature, the same laws of human nature. Somebody was saying to me, I asked, which tale grabbed them, and they said the tale of the bad guy, was the Franklin's tale, the bad guy, the really bad guy. Iago, Franklin, yeah. They said the Franklin's tale, the Pardoner's Tale, because that, he said, this person said, that's how people are today. I mean, or that's, the sheer evil. So, that's 600 years old, or however many hundred, about 550 years old, well over half a millennium old. But human nature doesn't change, and human wickedness doesn't change. The pilgrimage, Chaucer still has the idea of life having a purpose, life going somewhere. Now the contrast between the miller and the knight, the miller is pure Clinton. I mean, pure Clinton. I can remake, life is ridiculous. You must get out of it what you can while you can. Let the woman run wild. It doesn't matter. Hillary's going to do what she's going to do in any case. But there are plenty of others that you can grab hold of and fool around with and so on and so on. I think we all of us had, from Chaucer, I think Dr. White made the human nature such as we know it today likewise come out very clearly. That's obviously why Chaucer is a classic. And Chaucer is then, Chaucer's dealing in things that matter. He's not talking about machines. He's talking about the way human beings tick. Human beings are not machines. Human beings are quite different from machines. You can't understand human beings by understanding machines. The modern world is absolutely gung-ho on machines. It believes in machines. It puts its faith in machines. And yet, with all its machines, the machines serve sin, like to fabricate the world of the Truman Show. It's wicked human nature that exploits these wonderful machines, these in principle and in theory neutral machines. There's wicked old human nature which is governing their use. And therefore, which is more important, to study the machines or what governs the machines? Obviously, what does govern the machines is human beings. What's going on inside human beings is what's going on inside Chaucer. You can see it in Chaucer. So, the world tomorrow and the day after is going to be ruled, it's obvious, not by the masters of machines, but by the masters of human beings. Not by people who have an idea how machines tick, but by people who have an idea how human beings tick. Clinton is a master of human beings. I think he said America's like a woman and needs to be treated like a woman. And that's how politicians are. You know, it's a cynical thing to say. And it's a cynical use of human nature. It's a cynical idea of human nature. You know, you treat it like a woman, meaning you're a little bit brutal, then you're alternately brutal and kind, and then you, well, whatever it is that, you know, and handling a woman. But to compare a nation to that, it's very true. It's very true. You can treat a nation like that, and you can push a nation around like that. That's Clinton. He's a master of human nature. Like the miller, certainly not like the knight, but like the miller. And he was doing with the United States what the miller is doing with his clientele. And to understand the miller is to get on the tail of somebody like Clinton. So human nature doesn't change, and it's the same human nature which is behind the whole of the modern world, and yet the material conditions of the modern world have evolved to the point that certain features of human nature are being pushed to extremes, and certain consequences of certain behavior are being pushed to extremes that have never been seen. But the ground laws are still the same. In Dickens, the moral law, the fairy tale, good is rewarded and bad is punished. Uriah Heep and the other one end up in jail, and David Copperfield finally marries Agnes, and it's a happy marriage and so on. But notice the fantasy is coming in Dickens. Very first, one and two, Dickens' own life, and two, the docks. I think it's because of industrialism. England is in the grip of industrialism. The people are coming off the land. The natural country way of life is not too far in the past, and so people still have a sense of order, of natural order and natural discipline, and the laws of life, the laws of decency. But Dickens is beginning to fabricate a fantasy world. It's not a magic lantern. It's a novel which you have to sit down and read. But it's easily magic lanternable. Dickens makes good films. It's not difficult to put Dickens on film. I'm sure it's easier to put Dickens on film than it is to put Chaucer on film. Why? Because Dickens is more in sync with this world of fabricating our own reality. Hence, he's creating a fantasy world which is so real that the people are piling up on the dock to find out whether Little Nell is dead. And the sailors cry when they announce that she is. This is today that, you know, what was it? One of the characters on Star Wars went on a TV program and somebody's... Star Trek. He went on a TV program and somebody said, "Oh, Captain, what did it feel like when those Martians came after you and nearly zapped you?" And he said, "Madam, this is a fantasy." There was such an uproar. This is not reality. "Madam, it's not reality. I wasn't really nearly zapped by the... It wasn't real that I was nearly zapped by the Martians." The captain had to go on television a few days later and say that he was sorry that he'd said that it wasn't real. Is that it? The programmers obliged the captain to backtrack for trying to replace the fantasy, put reality back in place of the fantasy, for trying to put the fantasy in its place. This is because the fantasy means so much to people today. You want to say to people today, get a life. No. They want to get a fantasy. Get a fantasy. Not get a life, but get a fantasy. So the fact that the people are piling up on the wharf to ask, "What's happened to Little Nell? What's happened to Little Nell?" Get a life, you guys. Get a life. No. Dickens is their life. Already you've got there... Dickens is much saner than the fantasy merchants of today. But this... The fantasy is beginning. The detachment from reality, the substitution of an unreal life for a real life, is beginning. It's not healthy. Dickens's fantasy is healthy, but it isn't healthy as fantasy. It's healthy by its content, but it's not healthy by its structure. It's on the way towards fiction, which is completely detached from reality. And of course, today fiction is a lot of fiction today is of course directly diabolical. It's pornographic and so on and so on and so on. And that's back in the 19th century, it seems difficult. Or when novels began, some of you know Eugene Onegin. You know how the mother of Tatiana has read novels. Now she's come back to reality when she married this man and she got him under control and they live a decent country life. But her daughter Tatiana, not Olga, but Tatiana, is completely immersed in these novels. That we're long before television. And at that time, when you come back, Doc, you must do something on romanticism. You must pick one of the big romantic works and take romanticism to the cleaners, so to speak. For good and for ill. There's good, compared with what's followed, there's a lot of good. But the ill that's followed is there, it's this process. Here, there's good compared with there, but we've fallen from up here. And so on and so on. Here, O'Neill still has good. O'Neill is not yet the end. He's not far from the end. He's not yet the end. But O'Neill is a long way down from, and so on and so on. So, the content of Dickens is good is rewarded and bad is punished. The content is good, but the structure is already, the framework is fantastical, is going fantastical. And at the time, girls were told not to read novels. Reading novels was degenerate at that time. Now, of course, if a parent knows that their child is reading novels, they're delighted because, you know, reading novels is, you know, gosh, my child is reading. But again, it's the same thing. My child is actually reading is a ways way back up the ladder. But when the child was reading, when this child was reading, mum and dad said the child should not be reading. I mean, it was going down at that time. We're surely close to the end of the line, you know. And you, things can't fall apart much further than they're now falling apart. And that's the interest of the Truman Show. You know, a literature, it's interesting that we watched several films. Notice the documentary on O'Neill's life That's something that the magic lantern is good at. The documentary doesn't pretend to be unreal, although you know what they do now, they have docu-fiction. And Spielberg, in order to make the fantasy real, makes part of his war films look like a documentary. We all of us know the documentaries of World War II, the shots of MacArthur wading through the water and so on and so on. I mean, the documentaries have a reputation for reality and a deserved reputation for reality. So if I want to make my fantasy seem real, I will make my fantasy look like a documentary and I will make the documentary lose its reality. If I make too many docu-fiction, if I do too much docu-fiction, then the documentaries are going to, the reality of the documentary is going to be discredited. And you're back to, it's not a question of, you're back to human nature. You're back to what's going on inside the human heart and soul. What's going on inside Spielberg's heart and soul? The man is a villain. Talented, perhaps there's some good in his films, I don't know. But what's he aiming to do? What's he setting out to do? What are these today's movies? What are they achieving? What are they setting out to achieve? You're back in the human heart. What are the Hollywood moguls? Are they just out to make money? Or are they pushing a program? Television, certainly you've got a diabolical program overarching the whole thing. The thing is coordinated by human beings who are using the power of this in-the-home magic lantern to push the whole of society and human beings in a very specific direction. What is that direction? And why do these human beings want that direction? You're back into the human soul. So, how are you going to make Catholic priests out of youngsters who have been born and bred and nourished and suckled on technology, computers, machines, engineering, physics, chemistry and mathematics? How are you going to make a Catholic priest out of such a youngster? You're going to have to start, you're going to have to put the human in. You're going to have to re-instruct the human being. You're going to have to reform the human being. You're going to have to re-instruct. Instruo, instruere in Latin was to draw up. Aciem instruo, some of you may remember from Latin, I draw up a line of battle. So I sort of mobilize a line of battle and instruo. Instruct, I'm going to have to mobilize to draw up, to set in line the human being again before I can start trying to make a Catholic priest. In the old days, literature was taken for granted as part of education. To this day, most of you have still done at least one or two Shakespeare plays, usually Macbeth and Romeo and Juliet, as a sort of tipping of the hat to the past and a tipping of the hat to literature, and you know, but it's no more than a tipping of the hat. I mean, nobody really believes in it. Let's get the Shakespeare out of the way and then get back to H2SO4. H2SO4 is important, you know. Sulfuric acid. I mean, that's really significant. You know, with sulfuric acid, I can create a new anti-digestion pill. I mean, you know. And this is where people's hearts and minds and ambitions and desires and hopes now are. They've been led a fantastic dance by the devil. They're way off track. They're completely losing what matters, the things that matter. I was going to say, back to Dickens. I'm jumping all over the place. It doesn't matter. Dickens, one. Two signs that Dickens is on the way down. One, that he's so fantastical that he's stopping people from getting a life. He's getting people a fantasy. It's a sane fantasy, but it's still a fantasy, which is as such not good. As such. You may say, well, a fairy tale is a fantasy, but nobody pretends that a fairy tale is real. Whereas people sort of pretend that that Dickens is real. So, the other thing, Dickens' own life. I think it's in the introduction to the Penguin edition, that a brief chronology of Dickens' own life. And he married his Agnes and had several children by her, and then he went after another woman, correct? Which is very sad. It's human, of course. Gosh, goodness gracious, it's human. But it suggests that he was not immunized by his own... how significant is it again? How significant a strike against a writer is it if he can't keep the Ten Commandments, or if he commits adultery and goes off with another woman? Well, it may not discredit his art or his, but it does suggest that there's something he himself didn't have quite in place. So, Shakespeare I haven't much mentioned. Interesting there, I think, well, there are many interesting things in there, but there's a lot of interesting things I'm missing out, but the innocence, the good-heartedness of the mechanicals, the good-heartedness of Shakespeare's making fun of the mechanicals, of Bottom and Weaver and Quince and Snout. It's a very, very kind humor. He's not tearing them to pieces. There's no bitterness in the satire. Shakespeare is kind to his characters. Like somebody says, I see people say Mozart in his operas. It's has got the same sort of kindness towards his characters. It's Catholic. It's very Catholic, that kindness. But the innocence also. And how Dr. White said it, how the modern film, I watched just a bit, there was a possibility of showing you the 1998 or 1999 film of Midsummer Night's Dream, but it's tawdry, they can't play it straight, they have to play it with a twist, you know, they have to put a twist on it in order to, it's just out of tune. It's out of tune with the modern age. It's out of tune with the modern cinema, unless you've got a very old-fashioned director. Because as Dr. White said, the innocence is not there. Where did you talk about the innocence in particular? Was it with Shakespeare, or was it with somebody else? I can't remember.
The Shakespeare plays filled with it.
Yes, that's right.
Even with the young author.
Yes, but did you talk about the innocence in connection with Shakespeare with somebody else? I can't remember. The youngsters. Yeah, Dickens. You said, and this is a tremendous strike for Dickens. A tremendous strike for Dickens, that the youngsters today that can't stand him. I mean, one is very sad for the youngsters today, but the fact that they just can't live with these simple characters. These simple and honest and straightforward characters. You mentioned The Tale of Two Cities and how the midshipman just can't take it. It's very sad. It's very sad and very grave. And that's why the Midsummer Night's Dream was twisted, because it can't be taken straight. Modern audiences can't take it straight. They have to corrupt that innocence. They have to do away with that innocence. That innocence is a reproach. It's a rebuke. Notice the innocence was there in the Mendelssohn. And the innocence is there in Gilbert and Sullivan. The innocence, the Mendelssohn is quite, struck me listening to it this time. Well, the Mendelssohn, I'm sure it influenced the music of Gilbert, or the music of Sullivan, in the pieces of Gilbert and Sullivan. In Mendelssohn, there's that innocence still. In Gilbert and Sullivan, which is towards the end of the Victorian age, the innocence is definitely there. And it's joyful and cheerful. You don't get that today. It's gone. And this devastating lust, this devastating sex, it ravages the human soul. Our Lady of Quito in 1634, in a great prophecy concerning the 20th century. She said, the innocence of childhood will almost be destroyed. The children, there will be almost no more innocent children left. And of course, that's what we see today. It's devastating. And you cannot make Catholic priests out of non-innocent children. I mean, you know, out of young men who've lost and don't want to recover that innocence. It's impossible. The Catholic Church would eventually, could be shut down. And at a time, it's perfectly, the way things are going today, it's perfectly conceivable that there will just not be enough innocent, innocent enough young men left to be able to furnish a seminary. It's conceivable. We're not yet there. And of course, the Mother of God can protect young men and take them through a sewer and bring them out smelling of roses. God is all powerful and God can do how he likes, and this, and his mother. And there's no question the church will survive, and that means that there will be priests, and that means that, there will be, whether it's here or somewhere else, or I don't know whether the priests will continue to come through seminaries even. Maybe the classical seminary will go, and we'll be back to the Middle Ages with young men being formed by, in ones and twos with an old priest in the countryside. I don't know. But what is certain is that with, you talk about a flower being blasted when it's the cold wind or whatever it is, and it's blossomed and then it's just blasted and it withers and crap. When the innocence of youth is blasted, it's impossible to conceive of making a Catholic priest. I mean, a young man can make mistakes and he can be foolish and he can get into trouble, but where is his heart going? Where is his mind going? Where is his will going? Does he want to stay in trouble or does he want to get out of it? And of course, if he wants to get out of it, then he can recover innocence. But the mass of people today, the theater going audience today, they don't want to recover innocence. They want to, it's rebukes them. They want to lose it. But you've got it there in Shakespeare still. Dr. White says that you, I may have said these last few days, I can't remember. You can't find actresses who really understand the Shakespearean heroines, the Shakespearean heroines. Because in the Shakespeare plays, of course, for instance, virginity is of huge importance, and the loss of it is a disaster, and the loss of it completely changes your status, etc., etc., etc. And today, I mean, imagine the actresses today. It's a different world. That world, which was that world of innocence and marrying your first young man and so on, which is still there in Gilbert and Sullivan, that even the Victorian age, today, it was, the disappearance was being prepared. We were on the slide down. And, of course, the church held up. But Vatican II is essentially the church giving way to this world, giving way to the machines, giving way to the fantasy, giving way to the plastic, giving way to the loss of innocence, the scorn of innocence. Vatican II is the church ceasing to resist that and going with the flow. And when the Catholic Church goes with the flow, the game is over. The game is absolutely over. And all you've got is pockets, little pockets of resistance sustained by the Lord God, protected by the Mother of God, sustained through the Mother of God. And of course, such a pocket of resistance is what we have here. The society is that. But if these days aren't shortened, even the society will be swallowed up in some form or other. Or the society would be swallowed up. Our Lord says, if these days are not shortened, even the elect, were it possible, would not be saved. They will be saved. In other words, God will preserve his church. But if things went on, and that's where we're at today. The study of literature teaches then, the unchanging laws of human nature, which is our nature, and the laws of our nature, and I do not escape these laws. I am under these laws. If I act like this and this, there will be those consequences, and if I act like that and that, there will be these consequences. And I can't act like that and have these consequences, or act like that and have the other consequences. Such a line of conduct, such consequences. And Dickens shows that. You behave virtuously and wisely, and you will have a happy and wise life, and you behave foolishly, marry a foolish girl as a child bride, and you're going to be lucky if she dies. So the laws are very clear in Dickens. In Dickens, there's a real sanity. There's an innocence there. The innocence is there. And there's a sanity there. There's a health there. And a cheerfulness, which is very constructive. The moderns. So one, the laws of human nature, the laws of life, the laws of morality, the laws of the Ten Commandments, actions have their consequences, that those are permanent truths. And then the other great thing, the sense from literature of just how far things have gone today and how far wrong they're still going. So that you don't, like that Vatican II, the bishops must have, I mean, John the 23rd came on the scene and he said, folks, or he said, excellencies, don't worry, Pius XII had it wrong. Not everything's doom and gloom. The modern world isn't as bad all as that. Things are on the up and up. Things are peachy keen. Look how many radiators we've got now. Look how many varieties of ice cream you can now buy in Rome. I mean, the modern world is wonderful. Look at its possibilities and so. And the bishop seemed to have bought it. John the 23rd had not understood. Had just not understood. The modern world is junk. The modern world is trash. The modern world is wrong. The modern world is going dead wrong. He was fooled. And it's easy to be fooled by today's world. But if you look at these authors and if you set them in succession and you, especially an O'Neill, and then you watch what's going on in O'Neill and, very interesting. Very interesting. Dr. White described as the Faustian Pact. If you come over to the United States, if as a Catholic immigrant you come into the United States, this is the game and this is how it's played. So what was it? Either you give up your faith or you keep quiet and you become schizoid. You lead an inner life, one kind of inner life as a Catholic and another kind of outer life. You become schizoid. What was the second possibility, remember? Or you go back and you're still schizoid because then you're still divided because you left your family behind, like Mr. Tyrone's dad, like Eugene O'Neill's grandfather. You go home and you die, you commit suicide back in Ireland. An Irishman committing suicide because he's left his family. He could have stayed, he could easily have stayed, and then he'd have had to pretend that everything really was so wonderful in the United States. There were many, many, many Irish Catholics pretending that everything was wonderful in the United States, and by golly, they built up a powerful church, the Irish American Church. Most of the bishops were Irishmen, and they built up a tremendous Catholic church, Catholic seeming church. But it wasn't Catholic. It was liberal. The problem is serious. It's deep. It's huge. And the great temptation for American Catholics is to want the best of both worlds. Is to enjoy the prosperity and the radiators and the 747s on the one hand, and to think that, you know, there's no price to be paid on the other. I won't have to adulterate my faith in order to get along with this world giving itself over to things material. That I'll be able to worship things material and things spiritual without any problem. poof, oof, it's very dangerous. If the Society of St. Pius X tomorrow in the United States was to sort of begin to suggest that it had perhaps was looking at things a little too darkly, that it was perhaps exaggerating a little, that after all, Catholic University is not as bad as all that, that all these Irish-American bishops were really great fellows, that the United States is, there's nothing seriously wrong with it, wow, would we be popular. Wow. If we, you know, the longer she refuses to let go of her honor, the higher she can sell it when eventually she does. That's a horrible way of putting it, but as long as she's not lost her beauty. But that's a horrible way of putting it. But what I mean is that the longer you resist the world, the higher the price you can make the world pay eventually to... But St. Ignatius scorned the world. He spent 10 months in a cave outside of Barcelona. He was a brilliant young soldier, a brilliant young man. He only had a great career ahead of him at the Spanish court. He could have been a good general and so on and so on. He left the whole thing behind. He spurned the world. Within a few years, the whole world was at his feet, in a manner of speaking. He constructed the Jesuits, and the Jesuits were the spearhead of the defense of the church. And the church was back in the saddle, in a manner of speaking, to considerable extent, thanks to him. Love the world and it will trash you. Despise the world and it will honor you. Catholics can't compromise. Not even with sweet, glamorous, beautiful, wonderful America can Catholics compromise. So, you know, seminarians and young men, the modern world is way wrong. Don't dream of compromising, even if they offer you half of the United States to compromise. And don't be in any doubt that if you or I compromise, we would be outwardly honored, but inwardly despised. They would despise us the moment we started compromising. And we would lose... The salt would lose its savor, and there'd be nothing left. So, I don't know how much time or inclination seminarians, in particular, have to go further in reading the works of these classics. But the classics have a great deal to teach us. And it supplements and fills in what you learn in the seminary. The laity will forgive me for a moment if I sort of talk to seminarians in particular. The seminarians have heard me say several times, but I hope with these days you realize it again. The bishops of Vatican II had all done their theology. The bishops of Vatican II had their heads full of Thomas Aquinas. They'd all gone through strict old-fashioned seminaries, but they didn't really believe in it. They believed in the modern world. And so when somebody said, hey, here's a way of fitting together St. Thomas and the modern world, they bought it. They went for it. They had not, with all of their Thomas Aquinas, they had not understood just how rotten the modern world is. They hadn't understood how profoundly anti-Catholic it is. We're talking about Europe. We're not talking about anything particular to the United States. They couldn't have bought into Vatican II unless they had not understood the modern world. Why did they not understand the modern world? Well, there's the world, the flesh, and the devil. Maybe because they'd never studied it. Maybe they'd only studied the Bible and St. Thomas Aquinas. I don't know. And They'd never rubbed their nose in somebody like O'Neill to see what happens when Catholics meet the modern world, how the modern world tears them to pieces. So you may have, here's another comparison, this is one you haven't heard before. You may have a very precious stone in a ring, but if the stone is not well set, if it's not good cement to hold the stone, you'll lose the stone. The stone is the Catholic faith. Unless you have a sound understanding of the world around you in which to set that faith in that world, you're going to lose that faith. So the cement is trash compared with the diamond or the amethyst or whatever it is. The cement is nothing. But as a setting of the stone, it's invaluable. It's absolutely necessary. So a grasp of modern literature, of the movement of literature, of the direction of literature, the tendency of literature, in order to grasp the history, in order to see where we're at, is necessary in order to cement, to provide the frame, the faith with its frame and its setting so that it will hold and won't get lost. The bishops of Vatican II had the diamond, but they didn't have the cement. They didn't have the correct understanding of how this faith relates to this world. They believed too much in the world, and they thought that this faith could be compromise with this world along the lines of Vatican II, that there was some way the two could understand one another, and so they've lost the faith. And a mass of Catholics are losing the faith in that way. The permanency of human nature, the permanency of the moral law, of God's unchanging moral law, the permanency of how human nature reacts when it under that moral law, when it acts for good and when it acts for evil, the importance of good and evil, the reality of good and evil, on the one hand, those are the eternal truths, and the contemporary truths, the historical reality of where we are today and just how far today is degenerate, how far it's sunk, how deeply it's opposed to the truth. This dissolution of truth. There's a line of Dante against, many of you have heard me often quote this one, the souls, says Dante, can perduto il ben dell'intelletto, the souls that have lost the good of the intellect. Their minds are gone. Their minds are no longer capable of truth. They no longer believe in truth. Their minds are no longer looking for truth. Their minds can no longer grasp truth when they find it. The minds that have lost the good of the truth. It's a very widespread condition today. And the right use of literature is a powerful help to see what doesn't change from one age to the other, and then also, as I was saying at the beginning, what has changed today, how today is dropping lower than ever before. If you look at the visual arts, well, if we were look at, and I, next time, Dr. Roman, something romantic, he's in 3 years time, it's going to be Aeschylus, Don Quixote, what else did you say?
The Henriad
of Shakespeare. But there must also be something romantic, and there must be something dead modern, even Waiting for Godot, or something absolutely horrible, something totally horrible. The equivalent of, you know, Picasso and post-Picasso. The disintegration, the total dislocation of the same soul, how it's visibly the same soul as in Chaucer and Dickens, and how it's completely dislocated by following modern principles, by following out certain principles. Human nature is really just like an aeroplane. I mean, nobody that wants to fly an aeroplane dreams of disobeying the laws of aerodynamics. You study with a wind tunnel, you study in close detail exactly how that wind, the airflow over the shape of the wing to govern the airflow, to govern the vacuum, to govern the lift, the length of the wings, it's all minutely calculated and with a strict obedience to everything that can be discovered about the laws of aerodynamics. And in order to create the next generation of aeroplanes, they will create conditions with wind tunnels in order to discover what they don't yet know of the laws of aerodynamics. In other words, how air behaves. Human nature is exactly the same. Human nature is like an aeroplane, and the moral law is the aerodynamics. And if human nature, if a human being flies himself in such a way as to try to defy the moral law, he's going to crash. In order to fly, he's got to obey the moral law. It's the moral law, flying or not flying a human being, is even stricter than aerodynamics, flying or not flying an aeroplane. That's not the way the modern mind thinks. The modern mind really thinks we are the masters, we are God, we are recreating human nature, we can do what we like, we can act how we like, and there won't be consequences. It's the Miller and it's Clinton. Do what you like, do whatever you can get away with, and you'll get away with it. No. Well, Doctor, thank you very, very much indeed. Thank you very much indeed. And we look forward to your coming back in 3 years' time. If we're all here, still here, and if the seminary is still open, and that's not a certainty. Aeschylus, Don Quixote, Byron, the Henriad, Byron, and Waiting for Godot. That's on the menu, folks. See you in 3 years' time. And in the meantime, a round of applause for Dr. White. Doctor, thank you very much.